of Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe that we were going to try last week. And so we jumped from having two chapters to three chapters. A, how did that work out?
Good.
Fine. Okay. Yeah, they're short. They read pretty quickly. I just don't want to do too much. Mainly because there's so much to talk about.
Right.
Not because it's hard reading, but I get excited about some of these moments that occur. And I want us to be able to talk about them. And if we have too many chapters at once, even though it was easy reading, I mean, how do you cover nine chapters in a single? You just can't do it.
Yeah,
so
I think we should just do two.
Two next time instead of three?
I agree.
Okay. Well,
even though we have someone that is on the book.
we'll try that. We did three this time. We'll try two next time. All right, so remind me at the end of class that we're gonna do two. Okay, so chapter three, Edmund and the Wardrobe. So we ended chapter two with the Pevensey children have now been evacuated out of the city and into the country. They are at this enormous ancient house with the elderly professor. They're out in the woods and there's all these amazing things they can do, but they get rained out, and so they start exploring. And in this exploration, Lucy, the youngest of the four, finds a rather boring room that all it has is this large wardrobe and a dead fly. She goes into the wardrobe because it's awesome and she loves fur and it's just kind of neat, but winds up, it's a portal, so to speak, into this different land. And for however old she is, 6-7 years old probably, she handles it very well, very gracefully, and with a spirit of adventure. And she meets Mr. Tumnus the Fawn, and we have this little interaction where they are back in his home, having a lovely tea, eating sardines on toast. And he gives her just sort of the barest hint of this land, Narnia. Didn't talk too much about it. I mean, he gives some older history, but not that much about present day circumstances, at least not until the end.
Just that it's always winter, it's, and there's no Christmas.
Always winter and never Christmas. Yeah. And I still love that phrase so much, because for a child, it's just such an evocative phrase of misery. It's always winter. You always have to bundle up. You can't go outside and play very much. You're going to have runny noses. And you're either going to be too hot or you're going to be too cold. And your parents are always making you stay inside instead of doing the stuff that you want to do. And it's just cumbersome and it's annoying and it's frustrating. But the good of it never happens. There's nothing to look forward to other than more of the same. And I think it's a fantastic way to put it. Now, why is it always winter and never Christmas? That's for a reason. It's not because of this land of Narnia in a general sense. There's a reason why it's always Christmas. I mean, always winter and never Christmas. The White Witch. Okay. So the White Witch has this spell. Narnia is under her thrall. There was a time where that wasn't the case. And Mr. Tumnus talks about that. I mean, there used to be festivals and dancing, and the spring was amazing, and the very spirits of the trees and the rivers and the flowers used to dance all night, and it was this wonderful time, but that's in the past now. So for a long, long time, longer than we thought we could endure, because of the White Witch, it has been always winter and never Christmas. And so what happens at the very end of their interaction that kind of takes an ominous turn? Lucy and Mr. Tumnus, at the end of their conversation, it takes an ominous turn. So what happens?
He talks about kidnapping.
Yeah.
Okay, he confesses to her.
He was in the middle of kidnapping her.
He was doing it right then, but he has his change of heart. Why is he supposed to kidnap her?
To give her to the White Witch, and
why her in particular?
Because she's human.
She's human.
She's a daughter of Eve.
She is a human, and he has orders, just like everybody else. If you ever encounter a son of Adam or daughter of Eve, If you ever encounter a human, you must report them to the White Witch immediately, or else. And all these terrible things, and talks about plucking out his beard and sawing off his horns. And
turning into stone.
And she can even turn people into stone. So this is very, very bad stuff. But they leave on a happy note. This confession is accepted. It's received. He is forgiven. They part as joyful friends. And she heads back through the woods, realizing it's... I mean, I've been here for hours and hours and hours. We had TV and stories, and I fell asleep. And she makes her way past the lamppost in the woods. She finds the open doorway to the wardrobe, which she very wisely left ajar. And she bursts out, "I'm back." And this is where we pick up in chapter 3. So, Lucy has found herself back from this adventure, and what are the circumstances?
No one believes her.
Nobody believes her.
They all laugh at her.
They all laugh at her and tell her that she's telling stories.
Yeah. Now, it's crazy enough where she's talking about a world within a wardrobe and fawns and all this other sort of stuff. But what really convinces everyone that it's a game? There's something about the circumstances of the story.
Well, she wasn't gone for that long.
What did they say about how long she's been gone?
Instantly.
It just happened. We just walked out of that room, and you come bursting out saying you've been gone for hours and hours and hours. So, what do they initially make of her story?
That she's telling a joke.
It's just a joke.
Right.
It's a fun, silly thing. And kids do that. They have imagination.
Yeah.
And it's almost... whether it's just kind of the imagination of a young child, or it's a game. And, I'm gonna look over there, it's a bear! And everybody turns around, I gotcha! And so, let's think about the reactions for a moment. So there's three older children. Edmund's the next oldest, then Susan older than him, and then Peter's the oldest of them all. And we've had little bits of interactions between the four kids so far, where their individual personalities have been starting to diverge a little bit, so you can identify them. So do you recall anything about how the three older children individually responded to Lucy's story?
Edmund's being nasty.
Edmund's being a little rear end.
Right.
He is just a little so-and-so.
Yeah.
He's nasty.
He's
mean.
Being nasty.
And mean.
Nasty, spiteful, mean. There is something about Edmund that is so incredibly identifiable. Edmund's responses, while regrettable, seem super real to me. Not the least of which is, as we go through this book and you'll see, the depths of Edmund's awfulness has not yet fully been plumbed. As a child, I would have wanted to have been Peter.
Oh, okay.
But the reality was I was probably Edmund. Okay. Edmund's going to make himself more important by bringing Lucy down. Anybody catch some of the things that he does in particular about that? I mean, he really sticks it to her a few ways. But in these opening conversations about it, and to me this is very realistic. Have you noticed anything about how he treats her?
He tells her she's a liar, for one thing.
Okay, so there's lies, and that's a nasty way to put it.
He's curious about what she's saying about this wardrobe.
Okay.
And I believe he wants to look into it. He wants to see it for himself, by himself.
And that's quite possible.
Right.
Because he's not interested in sharing anything.
Oh.
And it's possible that, come on in. It's possible that what, even if there is something amazing about this, he wouldn't tell the other folks anyway. It really stood out to me that one of the things that he doesn't really stick it to Lucy is he acts so superior.
Yeah.
Oh,
you
young children
yeah.
these
yeah.
days.
Yeah.
And how much older is he?
A couple of years.
One.
Oh,
he is 1 year older than she is, and he's those babies. And he's just really just trying to be a pain in the butt.
Right.
He's trying to stick it to her, but he's also making himself look and feel more important. You know, because if suddenly, you know, she's one of those little kids, he's not.
Right.
You know, how do Peter and Susan see him?
It's a pain.
And he's probably one of those little kids.
Yeah.
And they're all relatively close in age. But for him to kind of take on this smug, superior attitude just rubs everybody the wrong way.
And Susan, the mother, she tries to point out to Lucy that this can't be.
Yes.
By bringing her back to the wardrobe and having her touch the back.
Sure. And, you know, and Peter, he takes kind of a sensible fatherly tack about it where, okay, you've had your little joke, and that was very interesting. Can we please just let this go? He doesn't berate her. He doesn't say you're acting stupid or anything. But there's this very clear, almost paternalistic, like, please stop. You know, we've all had our fun, but you keeping this up is, you know, let's not do that. So, what's Lucy's response to all this?
Well, she is very hurt that she knows that if she would just say, okay, you know, I made it up, then that's a lie. And she is very truthful.
Right.
So she's got her integrity.
And she believes in it. Right.
She starts to cry like any kid that is.
Right.
Sure.
Yeah.
Everyone has just told her that she's lying.
Yeah.
Now, and I get on to my own kids about this, or when I'm working with the scouts or the martial arts kids. I don't like the epithet liar. I don't like that. Because to me, it's very serious.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you call someone, you know, you're a liar. You're kind of looking for a very weighty, very, you know, like... It's a heavy strike to character and integrity. And one of the things I try to say, okay, now, are they mistaken about something, or are they maliciously and purposefully telling you something that's not the truth? And there's a huge difference to me, and I want the kids to know that because they get mad.
Right.
Like, you know, that's not right. You're a liar. Wait a second. You know, somebody's telling something and you disagree with them doesn't make them a liar. Even if they're wrong. Have you ever misunderstood something? Have you ever thought you saw what happened, but you came a few seconds late, you didn't get the whole context, or you thought you saw it, but you're kind of remembering it wrongly after the fact? None of those are lies. And I want to kind of get across to them to be very careful about your language. Not just because, you know, in a technical sense, a lie really needs to have a purpose and malice attached to it. You know, lies are not mistakes. You know it's wrong, and you say it anyway. Now we're getting into the territory of a lie. As opposed to, oh, wait. No, you're right. Yeah, that didn't happen. Or I saw one thing, and you saw another thing, and he said, she said. Those are not lies. But the other thing is, when you call someone a liar, you're not calling out their action. You're calling them out as a person. Your character, your integrity, your personality, you. You are not a person. You are not my friend. You are not whoever I know you to be. You are a liar. And that, to me, that hangs very heavy. And I want... you know, the kids that I work with or my own children, to not be casual with that. Is there a time and a place to call out a lie?
Yeah. We're having some of that in politics.
I think so. I think you know, there are real lies out there, and there are real liars. But you know, the problem is, if everyone that you think is wrong is a liar, then who isn't? Who isn't a liar? Then everybody's a liar.
Yeah.
Or you told a lie once in your life, you're a liar. And like, okay, you know, where are we going to get with this? That's how suddenly everyone's a Nazi. Everyone is literally worse than Hitler because, you know, once everyone's a Nazi, I got to tell you the truth, no one's a Nazi. So you know, nasty, heated political speech right now is of such a degree of hyperbole, it becomes completely counterproductive. I disagree with you vociferously. I think you are dead wrong. I think you're even, you know, I'm really worried about why you think something so wrong like that, as opposed to I dismiss you utterly and completely because I have now given you a name of the worst thing I can think of. And for kids, one of the worst things they can think of is calling somebody a liar. And if you don't think so, watch the other child's response when being called a liar. I am not! I mean, it's usually like immediate and because that's a big deal.
I found at work, while we're investigating an accident, and people saying that he's lying, or not even an incident, and then somebody would say, well, he's lying. And invariably, I found that to be true. Where were you standing when you saw that? At what time? And it all, that person's perception.
Right, and it always bugs me when people jump to liar.
Yeah, and then they kind of would calm down.
It's a good word.
Okay, yeah. It's not that he's saying, because he says something different than me, that he's thinking I'm a liar. And I'm saying, maybe I was standing at a different place or a different time. Yeah.
And it makes a difference, and I think we see that in Lucy.
Yeah.
You know, the responses of Peter and Susan are kind of like, okay, and, you know, enough's enough. And Edmund's is nasty and mocking. But for all of it, she feels like no one's believing her.
Very hurtful.
And she is hurt. She cries. She's miserable. They spend the next couple of days, and it's just, you know, you ever had one of those moments where either an argument or a fight or something like that, and it just kind of casts a pall on everything else. And even if you sort of make up, everyone's just kind of down. Yeah. And it just sort of messes up everything. And that is kind of how I see this. And he says, you know, it's a few days where everything is just kind of lousy.
But she struggled, and even though she feels so horrible, she won't lie.
She won't lie. Isn't that interesting? That her integrity says, even though everybody would probably just forget all about this if I just said I made it all up, her sense of honesty and that personal character is so strong.
Even though she just can't
do it.
Even though she's
the person. There's an easy way out. There's an easy way out, but she just can't do it.
They said that there were 3 days of her, several days. The weather was great, so they had a good time, but not Lucy.
Nope. And if she's overtly miserable, then, you know, it's probably making a difference for everybody, except maybe Edna. Okay, so how does the story take another twist? Because it could be that eventually she would just kind of get over it, they would all forget about it, and even Edmund's teasing would get a little boring after a while. So something has to happen so the adventure continues. And what is that?
A rainy day.
A rainy day. So now, instead of playing outside, we have to play inside. And they play hide and seek in this wonderful, creepy old house that seems ready built for hide and seek. And Lucy gravitates where?
In the wardrobe.
Why?
I think she wants to prove to herself that she didn't imagine.
Yeah, after a few days, she's probably having some self-doubt.
What's her dream?
You know, when everyone is against you, it's pretty hard to kind of keep up, even though I know it, but but
at that time,
maybe.
Yeah, maybe I'm lucky.
So she kind of gravitates towards it, and they do the hide and seek, and so she slips into the wardrobe, and what happens next?
Edmund
sees it. Edmund follows. Why does Edmund follow? Because he wants to discover Narnia with her? I think he wants to torment her.
Yes.
Because if she's in there, then she is pretending again.
Yes.
I'll catch her in the act, and I can really give her the business.
Yeah.
And he is ready and set to do that. He even jumps in, and what does he do to the door?
I don't get the significance, having read the next chapter of that. I mean,
I don't know. It's just one of those things. I think it's just a C.S. Lewisism, where remember he's writing a children's story,
right?
He's kind of the kindly uncle. Yeah. You know, sit down and I'm gonna tell you the story. And he throws in little childlike details that are just, you know, and one knows that it's never wise to shut oneself in a world. I mean, I think it's just kind of sweet.
Okay.
But it's just kind of a little flourish, I think. Because, no, it didn't change anything. Like, oh, we're trapped. Right. It didn't really change anything. I just think it's a part of the way he tells a story.
Like once upon a time.
All right. So what happens with Edmund? He goes in to tease Lucy, and
he can't find Lucy.
He cannot find Lucy. And suddenly,
he's out into Narnia.
He has made it into Narnia.
Yeah.
And what's...
Then you skipped something.
Did I? Okay. What did I skip?
Just like a girl.
We haven't gotten there yet. We haven't gotten there yet. So he makes it in.
Yeah.
He makes it in Narnia. Yeah. And once he realizes that Lucy's right, he has an immediate response of... I'm sorry. He's kind of calling out to her.
Okay.
He says, I'm sorry I didn't believe you. I see now you were right all along. Do come out and make it pax.
Okay.
Meaning, you were right, I was wrong. Let's
make
it up.
Peace.
Okay.
Yeah.
Peace. So it's like let's make up.
Yeah.
And we'll be square.
Okay.
And there's no answer. So what's immediately his next response after there being no answer?
Just like a girl.
Sulking somewhere.
Right. So even his apology is short-lived. And I just think that's one more telling element about Edmund.
Right.
He is probably somebody who does not like to apologize.
Yeah.
And if you're not going to receive my apology in the right... You know, I went to a lot of trouble to apologize. Well, forget it. Forget it.
And
snatch it right away.
To his own self.
All right, so what has happened next?
Here comes the witch.
Here comes the witch, but she doesn't identify herself as the witch.
No.
How does she identify herself?
The queen.
She is the queen. She
yeah.
is the queen. Now, how does he first encounter her? What is it? What's going
bells.
On? Here's bells, and there's a sleigh, and there are reindeer. Slater reindeer, but it's not Santa Claus. It's not Christmas because it's never Christmas. Instead, let's describe who we see. What do you remember of the physical description?
The fat dwarf.
Fat dwarf, super long beard.
Right. Yeah, working like a, almost like a blanket over his knees, like that, keeping him warm.
Yep.
His beard.
And so he's the driver of the sleigh, and he sort of operates kind of like a valet or a footman, or clearly a servant. He's not just a driver because she makes him, you know, she orders him around a little bit, right? Now, okay, so wintertime, sleigh, reindeer, and even dwarves. Very Christmassy, right?
Yes.
If we've got that image in our head, what would a dwarf in that circumstance be like in your imagination?
An elf?
Like an elf, maybe? Like, I'm thinking kind of happy and jolly, maybe?
Maybe,
yeah.
No,
And who's, what's the, we don't get it immediately, but what's the personality of this dwarf like?
The what?
The dwarf.
He's fat, he's got a pointed
head.
Right, and again, because of all the Christmas imagery, we might get kind of jolly and round or whatever, but what is he really like?
He's grumpy.
He's grumpy. He's kind of nasty.
Yeah.
Remember that a little bit later, he's going to give things to Edmund with a little smile and a bow, but it's a creepy smile and kind of a sneer. So amidst all of this, like, oh, it's, you know, happy and sleighs and reindeers and a dwarf and except he's kind of a nasty little thing. But that will fit with the queen. What's the queen like?
Tall, white fur, golden crown.
How tall?
Very tall.
Very, very tall. Tallest woman that Edmund's ever seen.
She's very stern.
Very stern. Is she ugly like a witch?
No.
Beautiful. She's beautiful. She's probably strikingly beautiful, but what kind of beauty?
Icy.
Even her beauty is a cold, distant, and stern sort of beauty. She may be physically beautiful, but it's a beauty that rather than enchant, this beauty intimidates.
Imagine having white skin.
How white is her skin?
Her face is absolutely white, like snow.
Like snow. Or sugar.
There you go, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But red lips. Would that be jarring?
All right, and so here's Edmund standing on the side of this pathway looking like a doofus, and the queen just happens to be coming by. So this must be like a trail or a path of some sort. And how do they first encounter one another? What happens?
Well, she says, "What, pray, are you?"
Yes.
And asks if he's
so human. She notices him, makes the dwarf stop, and then she wants to inquire about him. Is this a polite inquiry?
No.
It's imperious from the beginning.
Who would be getting that, but what?
Yes. And what, pray tell, are you? And Edmund is flustered. She is now unhappy because this is not the way you address a queen. And Edmund's like, I didn't know you're the queen. And what's her response to that?
Is she asking if he was human? No.
Almost, but first she has to say, how can you possibly not know? That I'm the queen of Narnia.
Yeah, that's right.
You know it from now on.
You better believe it. And he's, you know, Edmund's still like, duh, 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 I don't know. And he's still very flustered. But the queen asks again, moving into the next chapter, what are you? And what might he be?
An idiot.
He's definitely an idiot. What does she think he might be?
An
overgrown dwarf who has cut his beard.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
He said, no, I'm a boy.
Yeah. All right.
Now he's suggesting that. No,
right.
Now.
Someplace in there she asks if he's human.
Oh, well, he just said, I'm a boy. A boy?
You're a son of Adam.
Does that mean you're a son of Adam? So, boom. Something has changed.
Mm-hmm.
This doesn't come from her observation. She assumes he is just one of the creatures of Narnia until he says that he is a boy.
Mm-hmm.
And now all of a sudden, she wants to know, does this mean you are human? And he says, yes. And she inquires, well, how did you get here? Because are humans supposed to be in Narnia?
No.
No. So how did you get here? And he explains.
Came through a door.
And she seems to think, I've heard of such things. Now her attitude starts to change. What happens with the demeanor of the queen from this moment on? She's been very imperious. She has been demanding. And she has been intimidating.
She starts to treat him with, I'm not going to say kindness, but a little more warmth.
Okay.
She raises her wand. I mean,
she puts it under her cloak.
Yeah. Before that, she almost obliterates.
Right.
And then
she picks up the wand, and he says, "There's fire in her eyes," but all of a sudden she changes her mind.
Right.
Why would she change her mind?
Because she knows there could be more. She wants to know.
Now, if she turns him into stone or kills him or whatever instantly, what does she lose out on?
She doesn't know what's going on.
There's a doorway. Are there more of you? Is this an invasion? I mean, whatever it might be. But clearly, her first instinct is what?
She's going to find out what's going on.
Well, her first one is to
her first it. Instinct is, I'm going to kill it, or whatever it is that she can do with her wand.
Then she kicks into cautious and calculating.
Yes, and she starts calculating. That's a great word.
Right.
Because suddenly, even her, even her voice changes.
Yeah. Right.
And suddenly she wants him up there, and she wants to talk to him. Mm-hmm. And so what do you remember from their interaction? What struck you?
His absolute fondness and for Turkish delight.
Turkish delight.
But he was wary of her in the beginning.
Yeah.
Right. He was. He didn't want to get up there with her.
He
was kind of too intimidated to not do what she said. So what changes that with an Edmund?
What he can get.
Mm-hmm. Starts off with, she has this magic bottle and it's able to create something hot to drink.
Right.
He drinks it. He already starts feeling better.
Warm.
And now she makes an offer. Oh, drinking without eating is so dull. What would you like? Anything in the world. Now, so imagine for a second, remember this is a child, and he's probably maybe 8 is my guess, plus or minus. You ask an 8-year-old child, you can magically have any food that you want in the world, what might we expect him to say?
Macaroni and cheese.
Macaroni cheese, that's a pretty good one. But it's gotta be the box. Yeah, like nothing fancy and nice. It's gotta be right out of the blue box. It's half macaroni and cheese all the way. Candy.
Yeah.
These are not long-term thinkers. You know, they're not gonna say, "Ooh, I've got one and only chance to, you know, I want
McDonald's.
I want perfectly prepared osso buco." No. I mean, they're going to come up with
something simple,
something sweet, something
peanut butter jelly.
He, what does he want?
Turkish delight.
You have a definition of Turkish delight.
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Now, what happens when he asks for Turkish delight?
Something from a bottle.
Yeah, the same little magic bottle that got the hot drink, and now he's got this container
with a couple pounds of Turkish delight.
Pounds of Turkish delight. Pounds. And he starts eating it. And they have this little question and answer session. And what do you notice about Edmund's responses the more he eats?
He gives more information.
More and more information. But what about his demeanor? Remember, he started off as very intimidated by her. But the more he eats...
The one is his sister's...
The more he eats, the less he seems to care.
Right.
And he's just worried. He's not afraid of her anymore. He's not even saying your majesty or the queen. He's just shoveling it in.
Right.
And frankly, his answers start getting a little shorter because it's sort of like she keeps asking because she's got this stuff she wants to know.
Mm-hmm.
And he is too, you know, all I care about, it's almost like, okay, you're annoying me. Shut up.
Right.
Let me eat my candy.
Right.
And so what does she want to know?
She wants to know how many of them there are.
How many?
And that 4 seems to have some importance.
Okay. So he's mentioned that he is one of 4 children. And suddenly, she is very interested. Very interested. Now, did you notice that he doesn't just say, "I have, you know, a brother and 2 sisters"? What does he say about Lucy?
He talks about her visiting
our... She's our...
Sure,
he, Right. He's now Sol Lucio. She's already been here. And she's met Fawn.
Poor Fawn.
He has no idea. But now, Edmund, either out of, you know, he doesn't know what he's doing, or he just simply doesn't care because, by golly, I've got Turkish delight. He is willing to sell out anyone and anything.
Is he selling out, or is he talking in ways that make him more a value to her?
It's a good question.
Here's my sense of importance. I know A, B, C, and D.
That is possible. That is possible. That, remember, he's a kid who likes feeling important, especially at other people's expense. And so maybe by giving information, he's showing himself to be smart. And that's quite possible. I would say I lean slightly away from that, if only for the fact that the more of this stuff he eats, he's just shoveling it in at this point, and that's all he seems to care about. That any plan he might have had to make himself look better is lost, you know, just stuffing his face more and more and more and more. As a matter of fact, there's this real funny line about, you know, I want to make you my prince because you're so clever and handsome, and he's like, huh? What? And, you know, and he's got, like, this stuff all over his face, and he looks anything but. So what is the queen's plan for that?
For him to go back.
And bring
his brothers and sisters.
Yeah. I mean,
she wants to meet him.
Mm-hmm.
I want a nice boy whom I could bring up as a prince.
Yes.
Who would be
I have no children of my own, so I'm going to entice you. I'm going to entice you with this reward. But in order to earn the war reward, what do you have to do?
Bring your brothers and sisters.
Where?
To her house.
To her house. Oh. To her house. You need to bring them to Narnia, and you need to bring them all to her house.
And he keeps negotiating with, I want to go to, she'll give him more tricks.
Yeah, because he's not, I mean, she's got a plan working, because she really wants all four kids at once, and what does he really want?
Turkish delight.
He doesn't care. So, Turkish delight.
Her house is full of
Turkish
delight.
Delight.
Oh, look at that.
Turkish
delight.
Now, Lula got this for me when she was in Israel. And this is, I mean, it's even marked Nazareth. And, you know, you can look, it's got some Hebrew writing on the back. So this is Turkish delight. And if you've never had it, your chance.
Oh, are you serious?
Oh, are you serious?
Yep.
At the bottom?
Yeah. Nope. We're going to try it. We are going to try. There's a green one. There's an orange one. I don't even know what the flavors are.
Are we supposed to eat all three at once?
No, one.
No, just take one.
Fruit flavor.
Now, you kind of need to know, I think, what is what.
Lime and green.
You're sure they're not enchanted.
We'll see. We'll might find out.
Okay.
You're going to turn into a frog.
Now.
Well, somebody asked me here when the rest of you were in.
That's right. So Turkish delight, it's typically flavored with like a fruit or a floral kind of essence. And this is a very old candy. It was very popular, especially in Britain, about this time. It was seen as, kind of exotic, but very achievable. Because even though, you know, it can have some exotic flavors and it comes from the Middle East, it's relatively simple to create. And I will say, I too kind of had a problem with the sort of the personal description, like really relating to the concept of Turkish delight, even though I read this as a kid, until a family trip one summer we went to Washington State, and in Washington State there was a factory that makes it's a confectionery factory, and they make applets and coplets.
Oh, yes.
Aha, we have somebody who knows what that is. So you can still see them in certain places, even in Florida, but you go in the Pacific Northwest, very, very popular. It's almost ubiquitous.
You can get them through a store in Chicago.
Well, you can. I've actually found them. It tends to come out seasonally, but you can find them here, but usually before Christmas. And sometimes they come with other flavors. So apples and cotlets, apricots and apples, and that's the flavor. And sometimes they have nuts in them. But describe this candy, would you please? What's it like? You just had a peach. What's it like?
Well, mine is refreshing. It's got like maybe
minty mouth.
Okay, you got one of the green ones, dark green or light green?
Dark green.
Okay, yeah. I don't think I have
it. Like mint, refreshing.
Yeah.
Okay. What else?
That's what I have.
It's got a gelatin base. The jelly. You make it. It's like making marshmallows.
Okay.
Sugary.
What else? No, I don't care for the dark ones. I don't like that mini flavor.
Yeah.
I like the fruitier ones. And this is a light green, and this orange have a fruitier flavor.
You don't get any more. You're starting to look like Adam.
Okay. So, what else about the candy can you describe?
It's not as sweet as I expected it to be.
Right.
Okay. Did you have a minty one? Maybe that's why.
I had a minty one.
Yeah. Okay. You got to try. They're small. Try a fruit one. Try an orange one. Or a light green one. Don't try a minty one. They're all small.
Oh.
The apples and collards are actually much larger than this. Yeah, it's good, isn't it? I don't know what flavor it is, but it's good, right? And that's more, and that's maybe the sweetness comes out a little bit more.
Yeah, well, it's not too sweet.
But no, it's not like straight sugar. But okay, so describe the process of eating this candy.
It's chewing.
And it's sticky. Don't you feel like you could kind of just start drinking a little bit on your tooth right now? Okay. Now, most of you have had, what, two pieces?
Yeah.
And these pieces are pretty small. I would say that they probably weigh only a few grams each. How much did Edmund eat?
Several pounds.
Within the course of a single conversation,
he
ate pounds of this stuff. And how do you think that went?
Probably went good for him because he started.
Did it?
Yeah.
it went good like a lot of candy.
it goes
down pretty easy, but then it sits there. And suddenly, you realize you've eaten several pounds worth of sugar all at once, and your body doesn't like it.
No.
Now, what else? What? What else could you tell me about this candy?
I think the more you eat, the more you want.
This is enchanted Turkish delight that she gives him, and so there's this very clear element of him almost becoming addicted to it. We would describe this as an addiction. Like,
right.
The more you eat, the more you want, and you would do anything for it. Now. I'm going to suggest that the nature of the candy itself is why it was chosen in this particular instance. Were there other candies that British children could have chosen over that time? Sure.
But
of all the things, Turkish delight, and it's an appropriate choice, it's not a crazy choice. It would have made sense for a child to say that. But Turkish delight in particular, I'm going to argue a lot of things in the story will remind us of larger issues, of other things that are important. They will be metaphors, or they will prefigure, or they will be an explanation of a more ethereal or esoteric concept that's then explained. Remember how C.S. Lewis is a particular genius in doing this, taking very esoteric concepts and giving them a very simple, easy to understand, kind of day-to-day conversational explanations. Okay? Turkish delight, I will say, in this context, is like the nature of sin. It appears sweet. It's very sticky. The more you eat it, the more it will make a mess. And it will sit in your stomach. And you will regret it. There is something of all the candies that could have been chosen that seems particularly appropriate Now remember, he is dealing with the witch who has this entire world under her wicked thumb. She does bad and mean and nasty things, and she offers him candy, and even in the sweetness of the way that she approaches him, it's very clearly she's got an ulterior motive. Very, very clear. There's a sinisterness about her. Well, even the candy
is sinister.
It's a sinister candy. And I would say, like sin, it gets stuck to us, and it makes a mess. And can you imagine eating a bunch of this, and it's all jammed up in your teeth, and you have the powdered sugar all over your hands, and then your hands start getting sticky, and it's all over your mouth. And even the way that Edmund starts kind of having a piece, and then you get the impression he just sort of dives into it, and now he's just in this gross mess. And how, like sin in our lives, do we start off with something that seems so small and innocent? As a matter of fact, it even seems enticing. It seems sweet. But even from the first bite, you notice that it's sticky. And ultimately, it's empty. You know, the concept of empty calories? Mm-hmm. And what happens on an empty stomach if you were to fill it with nothing but pounds of sugary candy? How sick are you going to wind up feeling?
God, I'm starting to feel sick already.
So this...
You made me take
That's right. So, I find Turkish delight to mean something more than just a candy. Yeah. Out of this story, from beginning to end, the more we'll kind of think through it, the more we might be able to see that there is a point that he's making that can come through even in these very simple, ordinary things.
And he's willing to compromise his siblings for more of it.
Yeah, sure. Now,
but doesn't the candy itself make you want more? That's the...
Right. Now, yeah, she said, it says that it is an enchanted Turkish delight.
Right.
And again...
makes you want more.
That's right. Yeah. In the description that we have, kind of seems almost addiction-like. But again, let's relate this to the nature of sin. It's sweet, but it's sticky. It will make you feel gross, and eventually make you sick. And isn't that the nature of sin as well? An empty promise, but then it keeps enticing you for more. That first piece was okay. Don't you really want another?
The deception of it, is that what you're saying?
What?
The deception of it, but also, you know, I think sin in our lives, temptations in our lives, are rarely discrete and complete within themselves. They tend to lead to more.
Right.
Either more of that same sin or other sins that will drag you down even deeper. This is kind of a, you know, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive. The little white lie, the thing you have to defend that turns into a bigger lie, that turns into a bigger lie, and then you have to start justifying it, and then you steal something to make the lie work, and you all these things, and they kind of spiral out of control, and it all starts very small with this seemingly sweet but ultimately empty promise. And isn't that what sin tempts us with? A sweet but ultimately empty promise. If sin was always awful with no positive qualities, who would do it? No, nobody would do it. We would say, forget, you know, I really want to go get that poke in the eye. No, of course not. But there's something about the nature of sin that is enticing to us. There's some pleasurable element, perhaps, but even its pleasure will be empty.
I'm reminded, and I'm not going to go through the story, of my teacher, my school teacher, talked about character and did the dot and went like that. If you lie, then you will cheat on the paper. Mm. And then if you cheat, you go further and further.
Right.
Because it's easier and easier and easier. Yeah. You know.
Well, you know, even it is far more common, I would think, and we've sort of discussed this in other formats, for someone to feel that sense of, how did I get here? How did I get so far away? Rather than everything is great and then I'm going to make this one massive decision against God, isn't it far more common that these little small steps just start to add up and even sort of sweep us away, and eventually people stop and say, how in the world did I get here? I am so, so far away. It was just one piece of candy. And it was small. But it was a little sticky. And I kind of wanted more. But that second one was real small too. These are all small pieces of candy individually. And before you know it, you've eaten several pounds. And you are about to just throw everything up. So, I brought the Turkish Delight. Partly because I had it and I thought it was fun. But so that we could get a sense of the nature of this particular candy used in this particular context. So it is, these are empty dang calories, sorry. And it's sticky, it's slightly messy, and even though it goes down pretty easy, eventually you could see with a few more pieces, you would start to kind of regret it. All right, so how does this chapter end? The witch leaves.
She gives Edmund directions to get to her house.
Right, and he'll know. Okay.
And she tells him to keep this a secret. That's a bad thing.
Because it'll be a lovely surprise for them to all come and become a duke and a duchess, while he becomes the prince and eventual king.
Mm-hmm. And not to believe Lucy, Lucy probably say something bad about her.
Right. You can't trust a fawn.
Right.
Anything that Fawn has said is probably suspect anyway. So she drives off, and Edmund is left alone, and then what happens?
He meets Lucy.
There's Lucy, who has had a lovely day with Mr. Tumnus again.
Yes.
And Lucy is so happy. Why is she happy?
Because now he knows that it
I think she's happy for him that he got into her special place.
Yeah. Now remember the character of this little girl.
Yeah.
There is zero sense of "see, I told you so."
Okay. All right. Yeah.
What is her happiness? Yeah, there, I mean, she's happy that she's been vindicated.
Right.
But her immediate response is, "Now we can have adventures together."
Right.
I mean, she's a little sweetheart. But what's Edmund's response at this point?
I've been looking for it.
Yeah, whatever. So, I think the several pounds of candy.
He's uncomfortable.
Okay, so our final chapter for today, back on this side of the door, we now have two children who have been into Narnia through the wardrobe, so they return back to the house. And what happens next? They all pat Lucy on the back, apologize, and go off on an adventure together.
No.
Mm-hmm. What happens?
Decides that he is going to not tell them that anything about it.
Yeah, he says that they've been playing in the wardrobe, pretending they were in her country, but not really. But he doesn't admit that he's really been out there. Not very nice of him.
Now, why does he do that?
Because she told him to keep it a secret.
Well, the witch told him to keep it a secret.
Right. I think that candy got to him.
Candy got to him?
He's still trying to make Lucy look bad.
I still think there's a character issue here where he might have come clean. But the candy was making him feel sick. He was sort of annoyed that she was right and he was going to be wrong. And he's already apologized once. Remember how he goes in the wardrobe and he apologizes?
Right.
But then when he doesn't get an immediate response, he's like, well, forget you.
Yeah.
Girls, they're so rotten.
Right.
You know, this is not a kid who I think contrition comes easily
to. He's not nice.
He's not very nice. Yeah. And it's talking about how he's starting to feel sick and sulky and annoyed. And then when Peter says, oh, you went in there too, it says all of a sudden, he decides to do the meanest thing that's happened so far. I'm not so sure this was premeditated.
Yeah, because he's got a plan, he's got a goal to bring them back.
He wants to bring them back. He could have very easily said, oh, I went too and it's wonderful, let me show you.
Yeah.
And that would have actually maybe made his job to get them to the witch's house easier.
Right.
But that's not what he does. What does he do?
He lets Pussy down.
He lies. He throws her totally and completely under the bus.
It's a habit. It's now become a habit.
It's now because, he's a miserable little wretch. And when given the right thing to do, even something that is an advantage to him, he just can't manage to do it. And at the end of the day, he's going to be a little snot.
Right.
And that is what he does. Is he lies and says that he was just pretending that they were playing a game. And he acts very superior about it. Oh, children. And how does Lucy respond? She just breaks down. She just breaks down. This is the girl of integrity and kindness. Again, when she was proven to be right, there was no sense of sticking it to him. She was delighted that they were now partners. And her partner just made her look terrible.
Yeah.
And she is brokenhearted. And she runs off crying. And what's Edmund's response to all this?
He's still being a little brat.
He is still just
that is his characteristic, because Peter says about him that you're always being mean to kids smaller than you.
That's right.
At school.
This is a habit.
Yeah.
This is a habit. He is one of those kids who probably makes himself feel better by making other people feel worse. And he has now done it again. Now, a more sensible person or a kinder person might have seen the response and come clean. You know what? Gosh, she just freaked out and, okay. You're right. It really did happen. But he doesn't seem to have that within him right now, does he?
No.
He doesn't seem to be the sort of person who can make that confession and seek forgiveness. He seems the sort of person who's going to double down. And when caught in a lie, he's just going to lie some more. So, you have now a situation. You've got a smug and obnoxious little bratty brother who was just not letting it go. And you have a younger sister who is typically happy and lovely, and she is just inconsolable. Peter and Susan, what do you do?
They're worried.
And this is pretty good. This is a pretty reasonable and a pretty generous response by them.
Mm-hmm.
They are worried about Lucy. Now, why are they worried?
Because she's usually a happy kid.
This doesn't just kind of, it's not over in a flash, you know, where, you know, sometimes kids get mad or they blow up or they get upset or they cry. I mean, this now starts to stretch and she is just inconsolable and nothing seems to help. So, what do they feel like they're facing?
A crisis.
This is a crisis. This is a crisis. So What are their options in this crisis?
Don't you want to go to somebody?
Yeah, this is now beyond that.
Yeah.
We don't know how to solve this. We don't know how to fix this. And again, that's reasonable. Again, they are probably, Peter's maybe 12, I think. So Susan's probably 11, 10, somewhere around there. These are still young children, older. But I don't know how to deal with this. So what's their solution? Let's go talk to the only grown-up we can think of. Because what might be the result of this?
He can fix it, maybe.
Maybe he can fix it, but what if they don't go to the professor? What's going to happen?
It'll be another... Somebody's going to get sick.
Okay. It's going to keep going, and they might get sent away. You know, we're guests here. And we've got this hysterical small child that we can't calm down and we don't know what to do with. We don't know this guy. He's not a relative who has to keep us. If she keeps making a scene, we might get kicked out. We've got to solve this problem. This is a real crisis. So they make this, because they're even talking about, is mother going to be alerted to this, and is somebody going to write a letter or whatever. So they decide to go see the professor. And let's talk about that interaction. How does it go?
Well, they get surprised by the way he reacts to it.
Okay. And how does he react?
He says, how do you know it's not true?
Ah. How do you know it's not true?
Yeah, this is a special house.
And what's their response?
Edmund said so.
Okay. And the professor reminds him, is that good evidence? If you had to choose between the two, Edmund and Lucy, who was the truth teller of the two?
Lucy.
Like a little bit, like slightly more often, or always?
Always.
Always. If given the choice between the two, they would come down on Lucy telling the truth 100% of the time. So why can't they believe her?
They're afraid she may be mad.
Okay.
And so, this is the she's not.
But why can't they believe her?
Their minds aren't open to another world and stuff like that.
Okay.
So he starts thinking about the logic. There's three possibilities.
That's right. Now, remember I talked about C.S. Lewis's tutor, the Great Knock, and he was, very so strong in just the raw logic, and he kind of drummed that into C.S. Lewis.
Right.
And this professor is kind of based on him. Mm-hmm. And so he's constantly, and I love this thing, what are they teaching in schools these days? And that's all great. But he wants to get back to logic. And so he says there are basically three alternatives within this scenario. What are the three alternatives?
She's lying.
She's lying.
Or she's mad.
She's crazy.
Or she's telling the truth.
Or she's telling the truth. Now, lying seems a very poor fit. We've just explained that she's always been so truthful, they would never, ever, 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 ever expect this to happen. So the Peter and Susan, once they were reminded of that fact, again, the professor has to lay it out. Now remember, you're talking about the child who's 100% honest, and the only person saying that she's lying is the person who lies all the time. So I don't think you can say that she's lying. And so the kid's response then is, the only other alternative is, she's crazy. Oh no, our sister is, she's mad. And what's the professor's response to that?
Just having seen her and talked to her, he doesn't see her as a possibility.
Yeah, why would you assume, this seems to be an extremely implausible argument that your sister, with no history of this, who's not exhibiting any other symptoms, is suddenly clinically insane. So the kids can't see a third alternative between lying and crazy, and the professor reminds them that there is a third alternative, that she is telling the truth. Now, what supports the theory that she's telling the truth? Again, he's all logic, and he starts pointing out details about the scenario.
Oh, that she wasn't gone for long enough time.
Right. Now, they take that, Peter and Susan take that as obvious evidence that she's making it up or that, she's crazy or whatever, but that's not logical. And the professor points that out. What's more logical, because she wasn't gone for any time at all, what was more logical that he suggested?
Different world, different time.
Yeah, if she was going to pull a trick on you or tell a story, why wouldn't she wait 5 minutes? Why would she come out instantly and insist that she's been gone for hours? Even at her young age, she knows that that's not a very convincing lie. So he has laid out the only logical alternatives. That she's lying, she's crazy, or she's telling the truth. And one by one, he starts dismantling lying and crazy. The kids are left with our sisters telling the truth. And how do they deal with that?
I know he tells them to mind their own business.
that's one of the best lines.
I have that line underlined, and I can't tell you how many times this week that I haven't said, mind your own business.
Right.
But to me, like my granddaughter's in Denver, and I'm on it, and I mind your own business.
Mind your own business.
It's a great line.
Yeah.
It's a great line.
But that's
so
hard to do if it's your sister.
Well,
or your
real
kid.
True.
That is, especially if you care and you're afraid that something's wrong with them or something. I don't know that I would mind my own business. I would never think of it. But if I had somebody like him.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the cold, sharp logic of it.
Yeah.
So he basically dismantles lying and madness. And it seems to me that Peter and Susan are very confused with the third alternative, which is she's telling the truth. They still can't bridge the gap that this is a possibility, even though he's kind of laying it out. You know, if you were just examining this, if you sort of granted that anything is possible, which of these three solutions are the most likely, they would all say, oh, that she's telling the truth. But because they've already eliminated the possibility, this couldn't possibly be true, that's why they're having trouble with it. It is attributed to Sherlock Holmes, though he never says it in any of the books explicitly, that, what's that line like? Once you eliminate all of the possibilities, then the final one, no matter how improbable, must be true. Or something along those lines. But basically, if you say it can't be something from the get-go, then you're limiting, logically, your actual possibilities to examine. And that's what they've done. It couldn't possibly happen, and it's not even worth talking about. Therefore, we're going to focus in on only these alternatives. And he's like, well, that's illogical. Logic would say, just figure out what the truth is before predetermining it. Now, as interesting as this is, and we love watching the professor talk about, you know, what are they teaching kids in school, and making his great comment about minding your own business. Remember now that very simple things and very straightforward things mean more. And through our other C.S. Lewis works, we have encountered one of his most famous postulates, his most famous kind of philosophical arguments about the gospel. And this is Jesus a liar, a lunatic, or is he the Lord? So liar, lunatic, or Lord, which says these are the only three possibilities. Jesus talks about himself. And so for people who say, oh, he's a great moral teacher, I'll accept that. Lewis wants to eliminate that from the get-go. Because he's not just teaching morality. Look for the Gospels, and there are things that he does and that he says about himself, about being the Son of God, about having the ability to forgive sins, about he and the Father are one, about people eating his flesh and finding life. That those aren't very good morals. As a matter of fact, he says he's come not to bring peace but a sword. And that he's going to set brother against brother and families against one another. And those good morals actually seem pretty bad. So being a good moral teacher is not really on the table. Because the words of Christ himself have only given us three possibilities. He's lying, and that's not good morals. But he's actively deceiving people when he talks about who he is and what he has come to do. Or he's a nut job. Like people who are in insane asylums because they think they're Napoleon or something, where he's made all of these delusional assertions about who he is and what he's come to do. Or what he says is simply and plainly the truth, and he is indeed the Lord. So the concept of, well, I'll accept Jesus, but only as a good moral teacher, he says, is not one of the options. Because if you take him at his word, his good morals aren't very good. If anybody else said them, you would say you're either lying or you're a crazy person. So if you look at the only Jesus that we can examine, which is the Jesus of the Gospels, you're only left with three possibilities: liar, lunatic, or Lord. And how well they are mirrored within the professor's insistence that these kids use logic to reveal the truth of Lucy's story. She's either lying about it, or she's crazy, or she's telling the truth. And people who struggle with Jesus, the great moral teacher, are like Peter and Susan. They have dismissed from the get-go any possibility that Lucy is telling the truth. Not because that's where the evidence doesn't point to, but because it doesn't make any sense. So I reject it without even considering it. I'm not even going to look at the evidence, because obviously it's not true. So for Jesus to be fully man and fully God, for him to be the Son of God, for him to die on the cross for the sin of the world, for him to be able to, you know, miracles and all that kind of stuff, that's just not true, because it can't happen. That's just a myth, a story, a made-up thing. That doesn't really happen. People aren't raised from the dead. So, therefore, I respect him because he's a great moral teacher. Like, once you eliminate the possibility before even examining the evidence, then you come up with these other theories that hold no logic to them at all. And so C.S. Lewis's insistence on liar, lunatic, or Lord is saying, apply Professor Kirk's logic, not just to Lucy's story, but apply it to the person of Christ. Don't come up with an alternative that doesn't hold any water, because it can't. It doesn't logically follow. Accept what the principles are and simply be consistent and logical about them. Because if you examine what he says and what he does, you are left with only three alternatives. He is either deceptive on a level of sinisterness, you know, that he would dupe people so fully and so fundamentally about something that's so intimate and important. Or he is completely insane and should be ignored. You know, the schizophrenic who tells you that you've got bugs crawling out of your ears and that the devil has told me to kill you. I mean, you can't pay attention to any of that. Or he is simply who he says he is. And he is the King of Kings, and he is the Lord of Lords. So, logic. What are they teaching kids in school these days? All right. So it looks like we will do 6 and 7 for next week. And we'll cut it back down to 2 chapters just so we can have a little more time on each. Anything else about these that we have discussed so far? Not yet. But we can. And we will... we'll take it up next time then.